Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program,
your home for truth in broadcasting.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, an awful lot going on here. It's in particular with regard to the politics of it all. And greetings and welcome to the show. Particularly with regard to the politics of oil, Newt Gingrich is orchestrating this huge campaign behind the scenes. He's discovered that the majority of Americans think if we drill more, that that'll lower the price of oil. They're ignoring the fact that the majority of oil leases that have been given to the oil companies in the United States and federal lands are being sat on rather than used. I'm not talking about offshore oil. So we'll get into that a little bit later on as the program goes on. Don Siegelman's going to drop by in our third hour, the former governor of the state of Alabama, political prisoner of Karl Rove. And we'll get an update on what's going on with him. Mike Gravel is going to drop by. Rick Perlstein in our second hour talking about how, in his new book, Nixon Land, that Nixon was the grandfather of today's politics of hate. Anthony Romero from the ACLU is going to drop by at the end of this hour just to give us an update on what's going on with the ACLU. Right now, Stephen Halbrook is with us. He's a fellow at the Independent Institute. He received his JD, his Doctor of Law, from Georgetown University Law Center and PhD from Florida State. He's won three cases before the Supreme Court, written several books on the right to bear arms. His website, independent.org. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on the show, Tom.
The Supreme Court just, this landmark ruling on Guantanamo, it's one of what are expected to be two really blockbuster cases that the court is going to be ruling on, the other being this Second Amendment case about whether or not Washington, D.C.'s virtually total ban on handguns is constitutional. Is that a statement that you'd agree with?
Yes, it is. The Supreme Court hasn't looked at the Second Amendment since a 1939 case, and before that, virtually never. So this is breaking new ground. This will be the first time, presumably, that the court will definitively address the meaning of the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
Right. That 39 case, wasn't that like the Miller case or something?
Yes, it was. Was a very narrow decision that both sides to the controversy cite on their way. So.
Right. And that was the case that essentially said that the government can regulate weapons and use that right, or that power, rather, to regulate things like sawed-off shotguns and machine guns.
Right. The court held that the test for whether a weapon was constitutionally protected was whether it was militia-type weapon or ordinary military ordnance. But I think the court now is going to back away from that theory. The court seemed right. That oral argument to be moving toward if it's an individual right, that it would have a self-defense component. But I think that they're going to back away from a military-type weapon analysis.
Now, if the framers of the Constitution and the authors of the Bill of Rights actually intended for there to be a right to own a weapon for self-defense, why didn't they write that into the Second Amendment? Why does it say in order to maintain a well-regulated militia?
Well, first of all, the text states that refers to the right of the people to keep and bear arms. They did not put in
following the militia statement.
Right. Let me
as part of one single sentence.
Right. They gave a reason for that right being federally recognized. They did not say duck hunting being lots of fun, the people have a right, etc. They wanted to encourage a well-regulated militia, and they felt that by having that right recognized on the part of the people at large, it would facilitate the creation and maintenance of a well-regulated militia. If people couldn't own guns and didn't know how to shoot straight, you could not have a militia, because that's what a militia meant, a society where a military component consisted of ordinary people at large who were part-time soldiers and not a standing army.
You know, we're talking with Stephen Halbrook. He's also the author of The Founder's Second Amendment, Origins of the Right to Bear Arms. And, Stephen, I have your book here, and I've spent a fair amount of time with it. And I would suggest to you that while you give, you tip your hat, as it were, you know, you give passing reference to the concern of many of the founders, arguably most of the founders, that we should not have a standing army. I mean, this is one of the big debates. And in fact, Jefferson points out that at one point, a total ban on standing armies in the United States ever during times of peace was defeated by only one vote
right.
in the House of Representatives. You quote, for example, Eldridge Gerry, who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and you know, a true patriot. And you say in your book, Eldridge Gerry clarified that the purpose of the amendment was protection from oppressive government. And then you quote him, and he wasn't saying that. He says, "This Declaration of Rights, I take it, is intended to secure the people against the maladministration of the government." He says, "What, sir, is the use of a militia? It is to prevent the establishment of a standing army, the bane of liberty." In other words, the maladministration of government that Gerry was talking about, that Jefferson was talking about, I can give you 20 different quotes from Jefferson on this, and I'm sure you know them as well as I do, was that these guys all felt that if we had a standing army in the United States during times of peace, it could do what Musharraf did in Pakistan, and that is overthrow or become at least such a large and powerful instrument that it badly distorts the civilian government, which, frankly, I would submit to you, we are seeing right now with a $500 billion Pentagon budget.
Well, of course, an oppressive government would be equivalent to one maintained by a standing army, and there were those who proposed in the first federal Congress that it would require two-thirds vote of Congress to even have a standing army.
Right. Yeah, this was the big issue.
Far afield from where we were at that point, you had most of the framers of the Constitution being opposed to standing armies. You had the capacity created for one, but they wanted to rely on a militia more than a standing army.
Because it was locally controlled.
With Britain. I agree totally with that. And
so why is it that people who are Second Amendment, hardcore Second Amendment supporters, let's say, I'm not going to use inflammatory rhetoric like fanatics or something like that, but why is it that the folks who believe that the Second Amendment is all about guns don't talk about that? I mean, this was the genesis of the Second Amendment. The first, second, third, fourth drafts of this originally, I mean, it originally arguably started with Jefferson's letter to Madison when Madison sent him the Constitution, and Jefferson was in Paris, and he sent back a letter saying, you know, this is all well and good, but it doesn't, you know, in fact, here, let me give you the exact quote. He said, this is his letter to Madison. He says, "With respect to the new government, 9 or 10 states will probably have accepted it by the end of this month. The others may oppose it. Virginia, I think, will be of this number." In other words, he's going to lobby his own state to screw up the Constitution. Why? He says, "Because other objections of less moment, she will," this is Virginia, "will insist on annexing a Bill of Rights to the new Constitution, wherein the government shall declare that, 1, religion shall be free, 2, printing presses shall be free, 3, trials by jury preserved in all cases," which is what the Supreme Court just ruled on last week, by the way, 4, no monopolies in commerce, what? Number 5, no standing army. Upon receiving this Bill of Rights, she, Virginia, will probably depart from her other objections. That, you know, why are you guys not out there saying we need to disband the standing armies and go back to militias? Because that's really what the Second Amendment's all about. It's not about whether, you know, some drug lord in Washington, D.C. should have the right to carry a MAC-10.
Right. Well stated. And this country's gone very far afield from that original conception that we would have either no or minimal standing army. But that doesn't preclude the fact that the amendment refers to the right of the people to keep and bear arms. The two clauses are not inconsistent. By having an armed populace recognizing the right of the people to keep and bear arms, that promotes the possibility of having a well-regulated militia. But as the anti-federalists pointed out, the militia clause of the Second Amendment was somewhat of an empty phrase-mongering because...
Not at the time of its passage.
There was already... the militia power was recognized in the text of the Constitution already, the division between the state and federal governments as regards organization and arming of the militia. But the anti-federalist people like Patrick Henry wanted a lot more than just a declaration that a militia was necessary for the security of a free state. They wanted a prohibition on standing armies, and they didn't get it.
Right, and maybe we should have one now. Standing, and let's qualify that, standing armies during time of peace. What they wanted was every single able-bodied male between the ages of 17 and 46, was Jefferson's original proposal, to be essentially drafted, to have to learn the you know, what it means to be, to how to operate a weapon and military whatever decorum. And then if we were invaded or there was a time of necessity, military necessity, the church bells would ring all across the country and people would grab their gun out of their closet and step outside their house and boom, you'd have the militia. But the local militia, it's basically what we have right now with the National Guard. I mean, that's the remnant of our militia.
Except that that's what's left of it, but the National Guard, when in federal service, is really part of the standing army. They can be sent overseas and treated just like an army. But
I know it's a malformation of what the founders intended.
Right, exactly. And the way you described it is exactly what the colonists did at Lexington and Concord. They had their own arm that they specified that they hunted. They were good shots.
Stephen, can you stick around? I want to continue this conversation with you for just a minute here, if it's all right. Great. We're talking with Stephen Halbrook, his website, independent.org, an advocate of Second Amendment gun rights, as I guess they would be described. And we have this big Supreme Court decision coming up. Stick around. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
We need a gunslinger, somebody tough to tame this town. Think we need a gunslinger, there'll be justice all around. I think we need a gunslinger, somebody tough to tame this town.
Well, is that what we need? Every one of us to become gunslingers? We're talking with Stephen Halbrook, his website, independent.org. A fellow at the Independent Institute, an attorney. He's won 3 cases before the Supreme Court, written several books on the right to bear arms. And, Stephen, let me just, for our listeners, just lay out my perspective on this, and then you can lay out yours and we can discuss it.
Okay.
I think that at the federal level, it's entirely appropriate that there be limits on weapons that can be used essentially as weapons of mass destruction, that is, things that can kill more than one person at a time. Machine guns, surface-to-air missiles, mortars, the weapons of war, basically. I think that that's an entirely appropriate thing. Yet those are arms. And the founders, but you know, as you point out in one of your essays, the founders, when they talked about, if you go back to Webster's Dictionary, arms meant things that you could stash under your jacket, presumably. But I don't think that they meant that, because they meant rifles. But in any case, I think that it's entirely appropriate the federal government to do that. And B, I think that with regard to handguns, that the regulation of that should be left to the states and the cities. It should not be limited by the federal government. So New York City and Washington, D.C. should have the right to say, we want to be a handgun-free zone. But on the other hand, in Vermont, where I lived for 10 years, it is legal without a permit to carry a concealed weapon.
Right.
And that should be Vermont's choice. That's my take on this issue. Your take.
American citizens have freedoms guaranteed in the Bill of Rights, and these rights apply not only to the federal government but to states and localities, so that it would not be allowed that New York City could have unreasonable searches and seizures, but you don't have them in Vermont. And by the same token, if the people have a right to keep and bear arms, that right should not be infringed by localities any more than it should be infringed by the federal government. Now, the case in the Supreme Court...
But if I may interrupt you, just the case, the right of against unreasonable search and seizure is explicit and unqualified. The right to bear arms is qualified by the statement that in order to maintain a well-regulated militia. It's a contextual assertion of rights rather than an absolute assertion of rights, unlike the Fourth Amendment.
The Fourth Amendment refers to unreasonable searches and seizures, not search and seizures. And the Second Amendment refers to the right of the people not being infringed. And it does not specify that they can only keep arms if the government conscripts them in a militia to keep arms.
But even at the time of the founding of our country, the ownership of large military weapons was controlled.
That they did conscript people into militia, but by the same token, the Constitution refers to the right of the people to assemble, to keep and bear arms. And so we're talking about something you don't need to be conscripted by government to do.
But again, the right of assembly is not a qualified right. The right to bear arms is a qualified
right.
Well,
all the rights are qualified to some extent. You can't assemble
on
somebody else's property. You couldn't assemble inside the Supreme Court and have a demonstration there.
Well, they're qualified at law, but they're not qualified in the amendments themselves. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, the
language of the amendment.
The First Amendment, we talk about rights not being impaired, and the Second Amendment, rights not being infringed. These are synonyms for, like, they can only go so far and no further. And so nobody's questioning, by the way, federal regulations on heavy weapons and whatnot. What's at stake?
Well, why not? I mean, if
C is a ban on possession of the type of firearm that's mostly used by law-abiding people for self-defense, handguns.
Right. So why is it that the police department of Washington, D.C. wants this ban kept in place and you want it overturned?
Well,
why are you not siding with the police?
Different police chiefs at different times have made diverse statements. There was a former police chief who basically admitted that the law had done no good and he didn't know why law-abiding citizens couldn't exercise the same rights as people in every other state in the country.
Mm-hmm.
D.C. has been the murder capital of the country for many years since this law was passed, and you go across the river to Maryland or Virginia, and you have low crime rates, and you still have the ability of citizens to possess handguns. And
right, and people can buy them and then carry them into Washington, D.C. I mean, I think you could make an argument that D.C. is suffering more from a poverty problem than a gun problem.
I totally agree. What's lost sight of in this debate are all the different causes of crime, lack of education and economic
lack of good jobs,
jobs and just a culture of criminality, the drug problems and all that.
Right.
It's oversimplification.
Stephen, we have just a minute left. I'm sorry to be moving this along, but
okay.
I'd like to get, if the Supreme Court rules that the Washington D.C. law is constitutional and they uphold it, this is going to give a huge baseball bat to the Republicans to turn gun rights into an issue for this election. Do you agree?
I agree with that. I think that most Americans think they have a right to keep and bear arms, and if the Supreme Court tells them they don't, they're going to be upset. And so when they see that they have rights protected by the Bill of Rights, these rights should be interpreted.
On the other hand, in a lot of big cities, a lot of Americans are very supportive of the restriction of weapons in their cities.
Well, there's a lot of restrictions that aren't at issue here, things like licensing and background checks and all of that. Nobody's questioning those kinds of regulations. All that's being questioned is a total ban on possession of an ordinary firearm by law-abiding people.
Yeah, well, it's going to be a very interesting decision, and the response to it is going to be fascinating. Stephen Halbrook, independent.org is website, the author of numerous books, including the founder's Second Amendment, Origins of the Right of the Right to Bear Arms. Stephen, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be on the show.
Good conversation. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com for our live chat room, AirAmerica.com. You can check out our video stream even.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Strong liquor then to calm his shaking hand, and tried to tell himself at last he had become a man. A dusty cowpoke at his side began to laugh him down, and he heard again his mother's words: "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town."
Yeah, this has become a real solid part of American folklore, history, everything else. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, we're going to run our contest today. We're going to be giving away a copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And, in fact, this particular copy I will be autographing for the person who wins the contest. The contest will be whoever posts what is, in Sean Taylor, our producer's opinion, her esteemed opinion, her favorite, we'll just call it her favorite post over at TomHartmann.com on our blog for today's show. So, you know, whatever you come up with. 866-303-2270. Before I get to your phone calls, I just want to lay out, I think that in addition to, frankly, you know, states and municipalities dealing with this, because there are rural parts of this country where the concern about gun control and guns are completely different from very urban parts of this country. And I'm a supporter of, as much as I understand the Second Amendment, I also understand the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, which, you know, in particular the Tenth Amendment, which says basically that the government is going to stay out of the business of the states. So if a state wants to regulate handguns in their own state or even ban them, or a city, I think that they should have that right. Here you have two parts of the Bill of Rights seemingly at conflict, at odds with each other. And I also think that we should have a national militia, not a national militia. I think that we should have local militias. We should go back to that founding vision, like they do in Switzerland, where we say, if you know, every, basically a draft. And I think that it should be an exchange, and it should be an exchange for free education. We should offer free education, whether it's vocational education or whether it's college education, to anybody who wants it. In exchange for that, they have to serve 1 year in some sort of a military service, or if they have a religious or philosophical, even a political objection to that, they can work in hospitals, they can work in nonprofits, in childcare facilities, elder care facilities, you know, an ecology facility, cleaning up the highways, planting trees, whatever. They have some option. But a year of service to your country, and then let's reduce the power of the federal government, as it were, of this national entity, and to take it to the level of local militias. This is Jefferson. He was writing, he says, our men are so happy to stay at home, they will not hire themselves to be shot at for a shilling a day. He didn't ever want to see the day when you had a national military that was basically paying people to die. He said, it is more a subject of joy that we have so few desperate characters which compose modern regular armies. That it proves forcibly the necessity of obliging every citizen to be a soldier. This is a necessity for a free state where there is no oppression. There will be no pauper hirelings. We got nothing but pauper hirelings here these days. Mark in Laramie, New Mexico, listening on KTRC. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. When you mentioned Switzerland, I was struck when you read the early American version of what a regulated militia is. When I lived in Switzerland, every man between the ages of 18 and 50, I think it was required to have an assault rifle, one of the finest select-fire assault rifles that we have in the world, and ammo, and get together a few weeks out of the year with his local neighbors, actually,
right,
to practice defending their land.
Right, and these are organized at the city and at the canton level, at the state level,
yeah.
And it's, many argue, it's one of the reasons, aside from the mountains, that Hitler never invaded Switzerland.
They stayed out of World War One and Two. There were other reasons like gold and banking and stuff,
sure,
like that, but to this day, it would be suicide. Even with nuclear weapons, they have bomb shelters dug into their mountainsides that can take in the entire population of the Swiss within 12 hours.
Yeah, the Swiss have been survivors for a long, long time, and they're following the founder's vision of this country with regard to the military. I think it was a brilliant one. Mark, thank you for the call, and thank you for the amen there. Alan in Seattle. Hey, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Alan.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I think we're talking about two different things here, and one is licensing and one is banning.
Right.
And as a veteran and a lifelong Democrat, I'm a very pro Second Amendment. And most of my friends up here that are liberals who disagree with the right to carry arms or believe it should only go to the military, I simply point to George Bush and say, there's a reason why I don't think any of us should give up all of our weapons.
So, okay, let's pull on that thread a little bit, Alan, because I hear that from a lot of folks, and I consider myself very pro Second Amendment too, so apparently we're interpreting it differently, because I think that the Second Amendment basically is an anti-standing army during times of peace amendment and requires something like Switzerland has, frankly. But setting that aside for the moment, the point you just made, make it again.
Yes. Well, I agree that they talk about well-regulated militias, and I'm not an absolute expert on constitutional law. I've taken a little bit of classes on it, but I also know the Second Amendment, the way it is written, the way our professor discussed it to us, it is written in the same way that all other rights in the Constitution are written about, in the form of individual rights as opposed to group rights, the wording that is used.
But see, so the Constitution doesn't grant rights.
Huh?
The Constitution doesn't grant rights. The Constitution limits the power of government.
Correct. So when the Constitution talks about limiting the power of government over a group or over an individual, the wording that is used in the Second Amendment is the same language that is used in the free speech and other.
No, but the point you made a moment ago was that George Bush was the reason why you think that people should be able to have guns. And I know that you're not calling for his assassination or anything like that. What you're talking about is that if a government becomes oppressive, as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, it is not just the right, it is the duty of the people to overthrow that government and provide for new services. Is that the point that you're making?
That is the point, but also in the right to carry and bear arms, there have been Supreme Court decisions which have said the police actually have no responsibility, and in case there's very famous cases on it, they have no responsibility to actually show up at a crime scene.
No,
and
I understand all that. Now you're talking about self-defense, but I want to get back to this issue because this is the one, like when I go on these right-wing radio shows, and I'm talking about the really, you know, like the shortwave ones out of Colorado, and they're literally talking to communities of people who are hoarding guns and food, and they are all about being able to overthrow an oppressive government. And my response to them is, do you really think that you know, having a Walther PK-35 or having a SIG or even having, you know, 400 AK-47s or even for that matter having a couple of surface air missiles is going to stop the U.S. military? I mean, you know, it's a joke.
One person will not. But my father was a member of the Green Berets, and he also served in World War II, and he talked about how it was very important that we even get plans on how to make guns to the French resistance, how they could make them from bicycle parts, how they could do these things. One individual with a gun is not going to do anything. 10,000 individuals, of which 100 of them have guns.
Right. But the French resistance were not successful. It took our army to take out Hitler's army. Ours and Russia's. It took an army to take out an army. And you know, if you guys want to be able to overthrow the government of the United States, which is not something that I would advocate, I think that we should be looking at overthrowing it by political means, you know, as straightforward. But nonetheless, those gun advocates, those so-called Second Amendment advocates, purists who say that we must have our guns in case the government gets oppressive, I say, you know, how are you going to handle black helicopters and you know, helicopter gunships and bombers there's no way. There's no force in the world, including the citizenry of the United States, no matter how well armed they are, who could stand up to the power of the United States government. So then why defend the Second Amendment on that basis?
Okay, the reason here is an insurgency like we're fighting right now in Iraq, okay,
right.
Can paralyze an army. And we find constantly, as is happening right now in Iraq, political developments then become such that members of the current military or stronger political...
But you've got a couple hundred thousand dead people in Iraq. You've got 4 million refugees. I mean, is that something... Are you wishing another civil war on the United States? That was the bloodiest war we ever fought.
Okay, I will tell you, no, I don't want a civil war in the U.S., but I will say, and I'm not agreeing with a lot of things that are happening right now in Iraq. I certainly do not support the war there.
Yeah.
But I know that many of those people that are dead were not fighting for Al-Qaeda. They're fighting for what they believe to be their freedom.
Oh, absolutely. The vast majority of them, according to the Pentagon, the vast majority of them simply want U.S. occupiers out. They
exactly.
feel that they have an occupied country.
Exactly. You know. And so that's the situation that we're talking about. And I think that's the situation many people are talking about on the right to bear arms, where, in all honesty, if the Bush regime were to get worse, the price of a couple hundred thousand dead to try to drive them out of power until we could get enough of the military to come onto the side of people that would want to restore the Constitution is not too high a price to pay, and I do not think Thomas Jefferson would think so.
Well, I, I don't know what Jefferson would say. He at one point he said the tree of liberty needs to be watered by the blood of patriots. That was during the French Revolution. After the French Revolution, when he saw the terrors and he saw, you know, what old Maximilian was up to, and Robespierre and the guillotine and everything, at that point he essentially apologized for having said that. I think that if we were to look at, and Aylin, thanks a lot for the call, I think if something like that were to happen in this country, we would be opening a Pandora's box that would be unbelievably bad. It would be a tragedy beyond imagination. It's not a road we want to go down, and I don't think it's a strong or even a useful defense for the right to bear arms. 45 minutes past the hour. We're going to briefly hear from the ACLU and then back to your calls.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Before they are, and I'm telling you, there's just strange stuff going on out there in the world. Drinking up to six cups of coffee, Louise is right. She's a coffee junkie, has been her whole life. I always, you know, I like coffee, but you know, six cups a day. Drinking up to six cups of coffee a day may lower the overall odds of dying prematurely. Women who drank 2 to 3 cups of coffee, for example, had a 25% lower risk of dying from heart disease than non-drinkers. It has beneficial effects on inflammation and endothelial function, which are the first stages of cardiovascular disease development, Lopez Garcia says, one of the lead authors of the Harvard School of Public Health report. Oh, interesting. Anthony Romero is with us. He is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU.org, and I am a proud and card-carrying member of the ACLU, and I encourage you to become one, too, ACLU.org. And, Anthony, you guys are into your largest civil rights and liberties fundraising campaign in history?
That's right, and we're 88 years old. But it's much more than a fundraising campaign. This is more than about money. This is about building the civil liberties and civil rights infrastructure in the red states. We're not looking to buy buildings. We're not building an endowment. What we're looking is to take our offices that have often been there for decades, like our Texas office has been there for 70 years.
Right.
And it's always been too puny. It's always been too small. It's always been the David to the government's Goliath. And to grow it to a 45-person office.
That's great.
Mississippi, Florida, Tennessee, Missouri, New Mexico, Arizona, Michigan. Why are we picking these states? Because these are often the battleground states for civil liberties, where gay rights is on the line, where choice is on the line, where the death penalty is still being enacted. Where
freedom of speech.
Freedom of speech, freedom of religion. All those issues play out much more directly in the center of the country than on the coast.
Right.
And that's why we're building this infrastructure now. It's so important.
Well, that's absolutely marvelous. I wanted to get you on briefly to just plug that and say that I totally support it. I know our listeners do. And now is a really important time for people to go over to ACLU.org and show their support for the ACLU, join the ACLU, become, as George Herbert Walker Bush derisively said, a card-carrying member of the ACLU.
One of our finest moments when he derided us.
Indeed.
That.
Anthony, thanks so much for dropping by and good luck.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Keep up the great work. It's great talking with you. ACLU.org. Check it out. Let's see here. Jay in the Bay Area in California. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I think you're a brilliant and honorable man. I just want to say that this Constitution regarding bearing arms, I think that's the most important thing we have right now. I believe Bush and his people are going to take over the country. I just have no doubt that they
are going to.
They were involved in 9/11. I have no doubt the Pearl Harbor effect. And if they stole the last two elections, what leads one to think that what they won't do? They federalized the National Guard. They weaned the military, Justice Department, and the Supreme Court and put in their own people. They've implemented a private military, Blackwater. They created doziers on 8 million Americans. They built detention camps in our country instead of continuing to build them. And most of our military is out of the country, and they monopolized control of our telecommunications and all our resources. And the only way that, and I believe the founding fathers...
So, Jay, you think that we need to have an armed uprising against the Bush Reich?
No, because it will not work just like you said. I mean, we can't take on the military.
So what do we do?
In any situation, the military has to go along with the people.
Yeah.
If we don't have the military on our side, it will never happen.
Yeah. Excellent.
Excuse me?
No, I was going to say, okay, finish your thought there. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm just saying this is one of the reasons I think they're moving most of our military out of the country.
Yeah.
And they're weaning our top officials in the military. Because they want people in there that will do what they say.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why if you're, and thank you, Jay, for the call. It's one of the reasons why if you're a senior officer in the military, you have, you know, $1 million job waiting for you when you leave. If you're sufficiently compliant in private industry, it's one of the reasons why you have all these private contractors. You know, about half the military in Iraq right now is private contractors. I mean, I'll go along with that. Jeff in Denver, Colorado, KKZN. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, I've urged that we take a pragmatic look at real-world examples. The countries with the most armed citizenry, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, have the most oppressive governments. Iraq had a dictator, but the citizens were armed.
Yeah.
While the least armed societies, such as Japan and European nations, have very free and stable societies.
That should tell us something, you're saying.
Yeah.
You know, the reverse argument of that is that the first thing that Hitler did in the Warsaw Ghetto was collect the guns.
Okay, but look at but guns are false power. Truth power comes from honest news media, good education, and accurate vote count.
Excellent
point. He did not get in through violence. He got in through a stolen election. And you see that over and over again. And I would urge all gun advocates to put, you know, the people who really are into guns, turn that energy into accurate elections, and you will not have an oppressive government.
Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much. Brilliant observation, as always. And to the absolute total folks who think that the Second Amendment is the be-all and end-all of everything, I say, there you go. John in Marin County. Hey, John. John, I'd already moved along. I'm sorry. David in Detroit, Michigan, and the WDTW. David, we got about a half a minute here before we got to wrap up this first hour of the show.
Okay, real quick. Good. I just wanted to say anybody who thinks that the right to bear arms would put down a government, an oppressive government, you got to remember the government has nuclear weapons. They would destroy you if they so chose. And the second point I wanted to make is I think this whole debate underscores the difference between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats seem to take a more intellectual approach to issues, and we really think about things instead of just getting emotional. And like you said, yeah, the right to bear arms, it sounds, you know, glamorous. We're going to, you know, hold off this oppressive government, but be realistic. That the right to bear arms would never prevent the United States government from oppressing you if they so chose. You need to have accurate elections.
Yeah, accurate elections. You need to have an informed populace. You need to have a strong national media. You need to have voices that speak back. Like here on this show, we need more of this kind of media all around the United States. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up after the news, Rick Perlstein, a senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, about Nixon land.
The Tom Hartman Program.
News without conflicts of global corporate interests.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The True People's Radio.
Tom Hartman.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. The politics of left and right, the politics of division, the politics of fear and hatred have been very much on display over the last 7 years with the Bush administration. They were pretty clearly used with the Bush senior administration in the efforts to demonize Michael Dukakis and whatnot. We saw them, I would argue, as well during the Reagan administration, although it seemed much softer. But the whole embracing of Ollie North and trashing people who wanted to investigate Iran-Contra. Rick Perlstein has a new book out. Rick is a a senior fellow with the Campaign for America's Future, that website ourfuture.org, for whom he writes the blog The Big Con, his website rickperlstein.org, and his book Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. And Rick, welcome to the show.
Tom, great to be here.
Thank you. This book is a tome, first of all. This is a doorstop at over 700 pages of text.
Yeah, I like to say I could have made it shorter, but I'd have to leave out the funny stuff.
Yeah, okay. It's a brilliant analysis of Nixon's time, and as some of the reviewers have said, you know, you bring to life the 60s and 70s in a way that few writers have done before. One of the most interesting pieces of this, in my opinion, is the idea that this whole politics of division, which many commentators dismiss as being simply intrinsic to America, you know, going back to, for example, John Adams funding a secret campaign to get stories placed in newspapers in the election of 1800 about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, that this is really not a historic part of the American political landscape, but at least in its modern incarnation, in its most vicious incarnation, is something that originated with Richard Nixon.
Well, I think we've always had very important divisions as a nation. And I think when we ignore that, that's not good for us, that's bad for us. So, yes, we've had racial divisions. We've had divisions over how to use our armies and things like that. But, yeah, this level of chicanery, this level of bamboozlement that Richard Nixon introduced into Republican politics, and, by the way, bequeathed to Ronald Reagan, I would say, a lot of the same people were involved. It's pretty unprecedented. I mean, I mentioned the funny stuff, and I was just looking over the book, and I paged to my favorite part, which is the part where Strom Thurmond showed the porn movies on the wall of the Senate, and that's a perfect example.
Mm-hmm. For example of?
Oh, example of the chicanery and bamboozlement. It was there was a Lyndon Johnson in his last kind of months as president. Nominated Abe Fortas, liberal, as Supreme Court Justice. And basically, they were having a really bad time, the Republicans derailing him using all kinds of technical arguments. So they said, well, he's approved, he's voted on the majority side in all these pornography cases. Now, in actual fact, they were all technicalities. In other words, he said that, you know, you can't ban this film because, you know, the raid was done improperly or something like that.
Right.
But basically, Strom Thurmond, with Richard Nixon's blessing, decided that he was going to make the whole hearing about the idea that Abe Fortas approved of all these horrible porn movies. In order to make his point, he showed them on the wall of a Senate office to all the senators, and then he showed them on the same wall for all the reporters, and basically made it seem like this is what the Democrats were trying to unleash on America. It was absolutely stunning stuff.
You know, it sort of reminds me of Ed Meese. You know, he was the head of that pornography commission, and he watched 800 hours of pornographic videotapes over a year and a half period, including child pornography, bestiality, and other types of pornography, and then proclaimed afterwards that they did have the effect of twisting one's mind. And I've always wondered about anything that came out of the mouth of Ed Meese after that. You know,
it's like, well, yeah, and Strom Thurmond, of course, was not, shall we say, a sexual abstinent individual. I mean,
yeah.
I can just imagine these scenes, all these horny senators watching these porn films and trying to act shocked,
yeah,
while Strom Thurmond actually feeds the coins into the coin-operated projector.
Right.
He's the guy who's, you know, famous for going into the Senate elevator and goosing all the women aides and stuff.
Right. Well, and ultimately, as I recall, having an out-of-wedlock child with his maid when he was a teenager. Wasn't that Strom Thurmond?
An African-American maid.
Yeah, African-American maid.
And also proclaiming that the races should remain segregated.
Yeah.
So this level of perfidy and hypocrisy is something that kind of the Republican Party sort of
bequeathed
to America.
It's certainly a hallmark. Yeah. Now we're talking with Rick Perlstein, the author of Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. And I'd like to talk about the fracturing of America aspect of this. The Center for American Progress is reporting over at their blog, Think Progress, right now, that at the Texas Republican Convention this weekend, there was this company selling buttons. One of them had a picture of Senator Hillary Clinton and said, "Life's a bitch, don't vote for one." Another one says, "If Obama is president, will we still call it the White House?" Race card, gender card, or actually the misogyny card. Yeah, the whole deck. I mean, the emails that I get, and I'm sure you do. I think probably anybody with an email account in America these days are getting these emails that are just absolutely vicious about Michelle Obama, about Barack Obama.
Right, and of course, John McCain has a technique for dealing with this. He says, "Oh my God, this is horrifying. I have nothing to do with this. I abhor it." And by the way, that comes out of Nixon's playbook too. I mean, one of the things I write about in 1968 in the campaign, when Roger Ailes invented these fake town meetings, he looked for racists to put into the town meetings so they would say something racist and use the N-word. And the reason was Nixon could say, "That's horrifying. I totally abhor that language. Americans have to come together around these vital issues." And then he would just basically give the segregationist position in more polite terms.
Right.
McCain's running the same game.
Yeah, and this is like Reagan, you know, his choice of place to announce his candidacy.
Sure, dog whistle stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So Rick, how do we, you know, to what extent were the politics of division, the Rove politics, the Roger Ailes politics, to what extent did these politics really, totally in their modern incarnation, emerge out of the Nixon presidency, and how much of it came out of the psychopathology of Richard Nixon himself versus the people he surrounded himself with?
Well, that takes 800 pages to explain, Tom.
Well,
no, I'm just kidding. Richard Nixon surrounded himself with psychopaths because he was a man of some pretty profound psychopathologies. Mm. I mean, one of my arguments in the book is that the country reelected Richard Nixon in 1972 with that huge landslide of 61%, even not in spite of his rages and dreads, but in a sense because of them. They really fed off each other.
Well, you point out how after Kent State, the majority of Americans said that the students deserved to die, that they caused their own death.
I have a quote in which a mother of three sons at Kent State said that if her they weren't shot, but she said if they were participating in the protest and they got shot, that would have been fine with her. And that was the kind of rage that Richard Nixon and George Wallace and Strom Thurmond were harvesting in order to cement their power.
Right. And it seems to me that we're seeing that again. I mean, here's perhaps a small example. It's not based in race. It's more policy. But Newt Gingrich has discovered that more than 60% of Americans, this recent Rasmussen poll, believe that if the oil companies just drilled offshore, then it would lower the price of gasoline and it would solve all our problems.
It's
fact of the matter
that
is that the oil companies are sitting on 33 million acres of federal leases that they're simply literally just sitting on that are not offshore, that they're not drilling because, hey, let's wait for the price of oil to go up a little farther. I mean, we're being played. And yet at the same time, Gingrich has got this huge petition drive out going. He's got almost a million signatures. McCain is endorsing this. I mean, they're trying to further divide America and turn us into a nation of, oh, those guys are the cause of our problem rather than the system or, you know, how do we solve this or whatever. It's not about solving problems. It's about demonizing people.
Right. And Newt Gingrich is doing this in a very Nixonian way, very politely, shall we say. I mean, Nixon was very rude and foul and scatological in private. But in public, he would talk like Newt Gingrich does now. I want to solve these problems. I want to bring all Americans together. Oh, and isn't it tragic and sad that our friends across the aisle have not understood that there's this easy fix to the problem of oil prices, and here it is. I mean, I don't know how they look in the mirror in the morning, but, it makes me want to fight even harder to get them gone.
Yeah. We have just 10, 15 seconds, Rick. How do we fight back?
Go to ourfuture.org, my great website.
There you go.
Listen to Tom Hartman. Buy Nixonland, which will, you know, you've got to learn their tricks in order to fight them.
Indeed. Okay, very well said. And rickperlstein.org as well, but certainly ourfuture.org. The Campaign for America's Future is a great organization. The annual conference you guys put on is wonderful. I'm always energized by them. Rick Perlstein, his new book, Nixonland.
Thanks, brother.
You're welcome. Thank you. Nixonland, the rise of a president and the fracturing of America. Rick Perlstein, great talking with you, Rick.
Right.
Keep it up. Keep up the great work. 16 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. In our next hour, Don Siegelman. Stick around.
Tom Hartman.
Joining the fight by taking on the right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, give us a call, 866-303-2270. Tip of the hat to the folks in our chat room. Hey there. I find this absolutely outrageous that the Texas Republican Party invites into their convention this last weekend, invites into their convention a company that's selling buttons referring to Hillary Clinton using the B word and asking if Obama is president, will we still call it the White House? Like, you know, is that some kind of sick and twisted joke? I mean, I'm telling you, the race card and the gender card, this is beyond cards. I mean, this is just plain old flat out sick and twisted stuff. I don't know how to say it more clearly. Oh my. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. A lot of stuff on the table here today. Rex in Castro Valley, California. Hey, Rex, what's on your mind?
Well, Mr. Hartman, it's so good to hear you, to talk with you, and it's good to hear you talking so much about our Constitution. But whatever has happened to the sovereignty of the public sector in this country?
It has been systematically dismantled ever since Ronald Reagan came along.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
He began the dismantling of it, the privatization of it. James Watt selling off public lands in the West. And when he was asked why, he said, well, Jesus is coming again soon. He'll make all things new. It doesn't matter.
Well, of course, we have to remember that the public sector, the majority of which is the working class of this country, not one single representative of the working class is in our government.
Meaning?
Not one single one of them. I'm just questioning myself, well, what kind
I, you
of
know, there are a couple people in our government who are not wealthy, who didn't come into it via wealth, and who started out as in the working class, as you describe. I'd say Bernie Sanders is one of them.
But the overwhelming majority are direct representatives of the business community of this country.
Right. No, Rex, spot on, and I totally agree with you. And we need to do something about it, and that's why I think we need public funding of elections. When Arizona and Maine went to relatively solid public funding of elections, and here in Portland where we have voter-owned elections in our city, what you see immediately, is average people getting into the political process and running for office. It's a wonderful thing. Don, driving in North Carolina. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today? No, Don's apparently not there. Mike in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Late news just in. The British Army, acting under Governor Spotswood's orders, has seized the Virginia militia's weapons from the armory at Williamsburg. Now, that news is a little late, but the point is...
I beg your pardon? This is like 230 years late, you mean?
A little bit late.
Yeah,
but the
okay.
point is that the Second Amendment was framed not in an academic vacuum, but as a result of real-world events, and it
yes.
was intended to prevent the reoccurrence of such events and preserve the states, which were seen as the guarantors of individual liberty against central tyranny.
Right. And it was designed to preserve the states and local communities. It wasn't about individual self-defense against criminals, although you could argue that that, you know, it was something that was not unknown to the founders, but that was not why they put that in the Second Amendment. And it wasn't about having, a giant national empire like we have now, where you're throwing standing armies all over the world. I mean, we have over 130 military bases outside the United States. It's crazy. It was about the local municipalities and the individual states having control over their own militia and then those being federalized but still being locally controlled during time of national emergency, so that there wouldn't be a Pinochet style or a Musharraf style coup against the government. Bottom line. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Troy in Westlake, Oregon. Hey, Troy.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Big shout out to KPOJ. I can't thank you people enough up in Portland for the broadcast.
Well, I think we're the most, well, in any case, we're having fun here. Yeah, what's up?
Oh, right on. I'm afraid my hackles go up whether the right or the left is talking about gun control. I've worked in a handgun safety course for about 15 years teaching new students the basics of handgun safety.
Yep.
And one of my students came up with a, I don't know what you want to call it. He said that gun control is not going to be the government kicking in our doors and taking our guns. It's going to be a matter of making them so unaffordable that we can't purchase them anymore as legal citizens.
Well, you know, a good gun right now is $200-$300 minimum.
Oh, more than that.
I mean, you know, it's just decent thing that you can shoot with at a shooting range. You know, it's. I would, to the extent that I'm not sure I'd go along with that, Troy, but I think the extent that your point is making, really what's happening is that we're seeing the value of the dollar and the value of wages decline, and the point that the impoverishment of the middle class to the point where the average person can't afford to buy a gun in those places where it's legal and perhaps appropriate to own one. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our phone number.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Sean is checking out our blog over at TomHartman.com, today's show blog, to read the posts. By the way, if you want to communicate with me, that's one of the very best ways to do it, because I do read those at the end of the show every day. And she's going to be picking out her favorite post, and we will be sending that person a copy of Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, the book that I wrote last year and is out now in paperback this year. So, downright strange things going on. Another crazy alert. In Vermont, the state has no laws against carrying concealed weapons. It also has no laws against public nudity. It's a very libertarian state, as it were. And so the town of Westmore, Vermont, wants to change that because some of the town residents are a little worried about the kids coming by, the nudists. You know, this has become a controversy at Westmore. We'll see what happens, what comes out of that. It reminds me of back, I don't know, 5, 6 years ago, 10 years ago, something like that. I was doing a lot of lecturing, and it was after Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight came out, and a group had booked me to give a speech, and Louise put it in our calendar, we publicized and all that. And about a month beforehand, just getting the details together, you try to customize your speeches a little bit. I checked out their website and saw that it was a nudist colony. So I went to Louise, or a clothing optional group, let's say that. So I went to Louise and I said, oh, this is great. You've booked me into a clothing optional group. You know how they say when you're doing public speaking, you're supposed to imagine your audience is not having any clothes, and it does away with the fear of public speaking. Well, having been there and done that, let me tell you, it's actually rather distracting. But it was fun, and they were great people. It was actually one of the best weekends that I've had in a long time, many years ago. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Ernest in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey,
Ernest. Okay, my question is this. Why, when we have the Congress, all people coming into Congress, asking point blank, the question is, if we allowed you to drill offshore right now, today, would that bring down the price of oil? They are naturally going to say no. Then the next question would be, then what could we do today? Not 10 years from now. What could we do today to bring the price of oil down? The only thing is the people who speculate. If the speculation stopped doing it, it could bring it down today, tomorrow. 5 minutes after this hit, the United States, the president could bring it down tomorrow.
Man.
All the rest of it, point blank, it'll be 10 years before any relief is.
Ernest, your question, though, presupposes, number one, that the oil industry executives are going to tell the truth when they're asking questions before Congress.
Right.
You know, that has not always been the case. You had the executives of the big tobacco companies, you know, essentially the same types of guys, and they all raised their hand and said, no, tobacco, nicotine is not addictive. I think your point is well taken, but let me just add a little bit of nuance to this. And the main point that you're making is that we need to educate Americans that the Newt Gingrich Republican policy of drill more is not going to solve the problem, because the problem isn't, a lack of available oil. Problem is that the oil markets are being manipulated in part, by a small cartel of companies. Much of it is called OPEC, which arguably is an illegal cartel. At least if it was U.S. based, it would certainly be a violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And secondly, now consider this. This is something you will not read in the newspaper. But consider that the dollar was at, and I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but somebody sent me an email on this last week, and I may be able to very quickly and easily find it, because it was just great. No, I can't. Anyway, the point is that if you were to look at the value of the dollar versus the value of the euro, okay, just pretty straightforward. Here it is. Alexis, thank you, Alexis. In 2000, $1 bought 1.2 euros, okay? And a barrel of oil was, say, $60 in 2000. In 2008, a dollar only bought 64 cents. Rather than 1.20, it's only 64 cents. So the value of a dollar has dropped in half in euros. So the Europeans, who are still paying for gas and oil in euros, are paying the equivalent of $2.15 if they were paying our tax. I mean, they've got higher gas taxes and things. But basically, if we were paying for oil in euros instead of dollars for the last 8 years, our price would have gone from a dollar and a half to around $2.15. So half of the increase in the price of oil is the devaluation of our currency. Why? Because the only thing we're exporting anymore is dollars. And dollars are having increasingly lower value because they represent the wealth of this country, which is diminishing very rapidly after 30 years of rape, rob, and pillage conservative economic policies. Secondly, I think that what we're seeing is actually peak oil. We're actually seeing that, you know, oil is becoming more and more scarce, and there's more and more demand for it. And you talk about speculators, an awful lot of those speculators are just average people who are in the marketplace buying and selling stocks. You know, they buy ExxonMobil stock for their 401k. They're starting to buy oil companies. There's a herd mentality about this. They moved into gold for a while, drove gold up to $1,000 an ounce. Now they're moving into oil, driving oil up. You're not going to stop that. It's not going to stop. Now it can be a problem, and it can cause a disaster, particularly when the big speculators get in on it. This is why we used to have laws against this. And then Phil Graham, the guy who is the chief economic advisor to John McCain, championed and pushed through the Enron loophole in 99, which allows the speculation in commodities like oil big time, you know, by big financial players rather than just the average person. And so now we're back in the 1929 scenario. So I would submit to you that those are the real problems that we're looking at. Mark in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, good to talk to you.
I've
been concerned about this for quite some time, and I've traced this back from the time I started voting when I was in college and I sent my absentee ballot out. But I have worked in many campaigns against Republicans, and I've seen that the people, a lot of the Democrats that I've worked with, are themselves one-issue-oriented type of people. I've always been a multi-issue-oriented person. When you look back and you see the track record of Republicans in office, going back even to Nixon and going all the way to the current situation, why does it have to be that Barack Obama has to get on his hands and knees and appeal to these other Democrats? If they don't see what's been done to this country, to unions, to everything from A to Z, from soup to nuts, I wonder if we're going to pull this off this year.
Yeah,
can you answer that?
Well, these are small constituencies, Mark, and I'm, you know, by getting down on his hands and knees for special interests, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about basically Democrats or people that have voted Republican, Democrats who voted for Reagan, Democrats who voted for Bush.
Right.
These types of people.
How do you see Barack Obama right now sucking up to these folks? I'm not saying.
Well, I mean, maybe I'm listening more to the media than listening to what Barack Obama wants to do. Maybe what they're saying he should do. Maybe
yeah,
that's
well,
what I'm caught up in.
I think you may be, because I'm not hearing that kind of rhetoric out of his campaign. What I'm hearing is the broader, you know, a vision.
Are really saying that to him, telling him how he has to appeal to those. And you've mentioned yourself in Oregon how a lot of blue collar white voters voted for Barack Obama, and that doesn't reflect what they're saying on the East
Hugely.
Coast.
Hugely, yeah. No, it's you know, there's way too much TV bloviation, and there's too much of a blurring of the lines between journalism and commentary in today's modern media. I mean, I make no bones about it that I'm a commentator, not a journalist here. I'm not trying to pretend to be a journalist, but on TV you see a lot of people who think that the commentators are actually journalists, and you find a startling amount of political commentary concealed as news being delivered by the actual journalists themselves on the evening news. But, Mark, your point is well taken, and thanks for the call. I think the larger issue, and the one that we need to be pointing out to Americans, is that there is a fundamental difference in worldview between Republicans and Democrats, between liberals and conservatives. That conservatives, by and large, are not fans of democracy, of small-d democracy, and they would be the first to tell you this, honest conservatives. They believe in a meritocracy. They believe that, you know, if too many people vote, if everybody votes, that that's not a good thing, that that's certainly not a good thing for them, but also that it's not a good thing for America. Like Paul Weyrich said,
"Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome."
This is the father of Republican politics. Good government.
They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Now, that guy was a major advisor to the Reagan campaign, to the Bush senior campaign, and to the Bush junior campaign, Paul Weyrich. Major Republican strategist. Let's cut down the vote. So you've got conservatives and Republicans who really don't believe in democracy. They believe in a meritocracy. They don't trust what John Adams referred to as the rabble, the large number of the people. And then you've got Democrats and liberals who believe that if you decentralize, if you give the maximum amount of power to the largest number of people and the minimum amount of power to the elites, that you will have a positive and good society. And that's a fundamental difference in worldview. And what you're seeing played out at the national stage is John McCain and the conservatives going to fat cats and holding small fundraisers at the homes of guys who say that if rape isn't inevitable, you might as well enjoy it. But he's got a lot of money, so they're going to hold a fundraiser there on the one hand. And then you got Barack Obama saying, no, we're not even going to take money from lobbyists. We're just going to go out on the web and ask people to give us $25-$50. And he's raising hundreds of millions of dollars doing it. These are the fundamental differences between the parties.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, Sean is keeping an eye on our blog over at TomHartman.com for interesting posts so that we can send out a copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and what we can do about it. Jim in Downey, California. Hey, Jim, you want to disagree with me about something here?
Yeah, I wanted to briefly touch on your very interesting points about the politics of personal discussion with the guy that wrote the book last segment.
Right.
From the point of view of someone who came of age at that time, just briefly, born 1952, so think it through, first presidential election that I was able to vote in was 1972. Politically interested and active in the late 60s, although coming in right at the tail end of the anti-Vietnam generation, but still of age to have made that personal decision that everybody made, that your name, the little ball with your birthday, is going in that draft lottery for Vietnam, and when they call you, you have to decide.
Right.
And saw friends of mine that were great athletes in high school 2 years later, ruining their health, starving themselves because they wanted to make themselves 4F and not be part of the draft. And saw other people didn't
now,
know anything.
Jim, you know, the point that you're making, I think, is that if we had the draft, then young people today would be more politically conscious.
Well, that's true, but that's not the main point, Tom. The point is, I vote in the election of 1972, and regardless of which side I supported, I'm looking at it then and now. There was never before or ever since, and probably never will be, I think you'll admit, such a one-sided, devastating electoral victory. And what happened? The other side, and you can tell where I'm going on my politics with this because I listen to you even though I disagree with you 80% of the time. It was as though they just said, okay, we don't care that this guy won 49 out of the 50 states. We don't care that obviously, like an overwhelming percentage of the American people, right, even if you disagree with them, they voted for the man. He is the president for the next 4 years. Let's spend our time being the American equivalent, and I think everybody always did up until that time, of
Jim,
a loyal
opposition.
Let's show the American people the
loyal opposition is an important thing. You know, Jim, if where you're going is, oh my God, they impeached Nixon. Nixon was a criminal. It just took a while for it to come out. Criminals should be impeached. Bush is a criminal. Bush should be impeached. We'll just leave it there. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service, on the line with us, talkradionews.com. What's going on in the world today, Ellen?
Well, I'll tell you, when in doubt, go back. McCain today, in a conference call with reporters, actually he didn't say it, but his attack dogs did, said that that Obama's plans to defend America are exactly the problems that led to the attacks of September 10th, and that he basically had... His whole plan was a perfect manifestation of a September 10th attitude. Now, also, he's expected to make a speech tonight on the environment, and he's also going to attack Obama again and say that his plans sound familiar on energy. It's because they're exactly like Carter's were.
Well, actually, Carter's policies were damn good. Carter was going to get us off our addiction to foreign oil, and he was going to have, by the year 2000, 20% of all electricity in the United States generated by solar power.
I built a house in the early 80s, and I had solar power. And when I built it, I thought, particularly for hot water, I thought that I was going to be able to take a tax deduction. Oh, no,
right.
Mr. Reagan came in, and there went my tax deduction.
There you go. Exactly. I mean, you know, Carter's energy policies were actually very, very good. They were very progressive. And if we had followed them, we wouldn't be in this mess that we're in right now. But I understand that John McCain now is, as David Donnelly, the director of Campaign Money Watch, he says, John McCain's big money donors and lobbyist friends have struck again. His reversal, he's flip-flopped on offshore drilling, is a blatant pitch for donations at today's Houston fundraising events. Do you think it's that simple?
People always ask me, Tom, why I think Obama's going to be the next president. One is demographics, and two is voting record. There's enough voting record of McCain to hang him about 10 times.
Yeah, he's just going back and forth on everything. But, you know, this whole thing about September 10th, September 11th, it sounds like he's trying to out-Cheney Dick Cheney. Be afraid.
I mean, he's trying to look more right-wing. And frankly, it comes off as ingenuine because that really wasn't who McCain was. And don't forget, he talked to the Democrats about joining their party.
Briefly.
Well, what I'm saying is that, and I've talked to people in Arizona, and, you know, who he comes off publicly at this point and who he was, at least in the past, are two different people.
Yeah, yeah. And do you ascribe that to politics or to, you know, it almost seems to
politics
me.
Politics only.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems to me that in the election of 2000, George Bush beat him up, or Karl Rove, you know, with the whole, you know, he's got a black out of wedlock daughter, scurrilous push-pull telephone thing in South Carolina and other places, all the rumor mongering and things, that he was so badly damaged and wounded by that experience that he decided that the only way to get along was to go along, that the only way to gain and maintain power, the only way to become president was to be just as bad as the bad guys, and he's become one of them.
Exactly. Some other good or bad, I guess, bad news today. The Department of Commerce released its housing starts. 33% decrease in May, the lowest rate since 1991. Wholesale price, producer's index, up 14% for the month.
Wow. Wow. And but we're not going to see that reflected in the consumer price index that's used to calculate and index Social Security because the government's jerry-rigging those figures.
Well, they certainly take fuel and they take food out of the normal consumer price index.
Right, because people on Social Security don't eat and they never drive anywhere.
Exactly. All right.
Everybody knows that, everybody who's a Republican anyway. Yeah.
Right. Our old folks don't drive.
Yeah.
Today also on Good Morning America, Obama was on and said that McCain is very likely not to really appeal to women voters. So that's interesting. Now, remember, we've had this ongoing discussion about Lindsey Graham up south, South Carolina.
Right.
And Lindsey this morning, although he was furious about the Guantanamo decision of the Supreme Court, he did say that the interrogation techniques, he really took off after our government on the interrogation techniques and the torture. So Lindsey's a mixed bag.
Yeah, I think he's trying to have it both ways. But in any case, it's interesting. Thanks for reporting that. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Don Siegelman up next. Stick around.
Tom Hartman.
Taking back the mainstream media.
3 hours a day, 5 days a week.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So our last greatest hope for bringing down the Bush regime, in my humble opinion, is exposing the crimes of Karl Rove and his buddies. And the best, again, in my opinion, the best wedge, the best way to crack into this thing, to pry this thing open, is to expose the prosecution, the politically motivated prosecution of former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, a political prisoner of the Republican right wing. His website, donsiegelman.com or .org. Remember, I before E, like they taught you in elementary school. Don, S-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N, and I encourage you to get over to that website and help him out, his legal defense fund and whatnot. Don Siegelman is with us. Don, Governor, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to be with you, Tom. Thank you so much. And I wanted to comment on your introduction because, I do believe that that eventually all roads lead to Rove, but this one, the one that starts with the Siegelman case, is the shortest route, and that is because we have a Republican lawyer who has placed Karl Rove at the scene of the crime.
Right.
A Republican lawyer who has said that she was on a telephone conversation with Rove's friend and political associate and business friend, Bill Canary, whose wife prosecuted me during this last campaign.
And he was also the campaign manager of your opponent.
Right. He was also, that's right, the prosecutor's husband was serving as the campaign manager for my Republican opponent, who was recruited to run by Karl Rove, by the way, recruited
right.
out of Congress to run against me. It was said on that telephone conversation by the prosecutor's husband that he had talked to Karl and Karl had gotten, talked to the Department of Justice and they were going to nail me. And so this is the easiest way for Congress to put all of this together. The interesting thing is that now Rove is claiming executive privilege, which means that it can't mean but one thing, and that is that he talked to the president about this.
Right.
If he's claiming executive privilege, he has talked to the president. Otherwise, he can't claim executive privilege.
Right. Just in the last couple of months, we've discovered, for example, that at the highest levels in Washington, D.C., the decision to torture prisoners was made, and specifics were discussed, and that George Bush was informed about those things. So I suppose they could claim executive privilege on that basis. But Rove's claim, has he actually used that phrase, executive privilege? Has he actually invoked that?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so that's essentially an admission that George W. Bush is personally involved in political prosecutions, is it not?
It is either that or it's Rove's way of trying to wiggle his way out of testifying before Congress. But, we have got to enlist the help of your listeners to write and call and email their members of Congress and particularly the House Judiciary Committee, because they're the ones who are pushing this thing the hardest, but to encourage them. They owe it to the American people to keep digging and fighting for the truth until the truth comes out. We have got to restore justice, and we've got to preserve our democracy, and we cannot let these Rove-led operatives, whoever they may be, get away with this kind of stuff.
Right.
And this is not about me or my case. As angry as I am about what they've done to my family and me, but this is about America, and our only hope and our best hope is with Congress.
Yeah, absolutely, and in fact, I encourage people to go. We set aside a page on our website, callcongress.org. We'll get you there, where we list all the toll-free numbers that we've been able to find that redirect to the congressional switchboard. You can call any of those toll-free numbers that you can find over at callcongress.org and the regular numbers there as well. And you will get the operator, the switchboard in Washington, D.C. And if you're not sure who is your member of the House of Representatives, or you're not sure the names of both of your senators, and there's no shame in that. I mean, it would be a good idea if you found out. But, you know, some people are just getting back into politics after many years. Simply give me your zip code, and they'll tell you, and then say, would you please connect me with that person? And in particular, members of the House of Representatives, or you can ask for Congressman Conyers' office. He's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. There are a number of other very good people involved with this thing. Any of the members of the House Judiciary Committee. But please be sure to call your member of the House of Representatives as well to our listeners. And
Tom, I wanted to. There are a couple of questions that people immediately ask. They ask, you know, why would Karl Rove be interested in Alabama? Well,
right.
Karl Rove came from Texas to Alabama after he was basically fired from the Bush campaign in '92,
mm-hmm.
and he was recruited over here by his friend and longtime political associate Bill Canary. Bill Canary was a special assistant to President Bush, George W.'s father. He was the chief of staff of the Republican National Committee. He was the field director for the Bush Quail campaign. He was Andrew Card's deputy. He was somebody that the National Republican chairman said that was a political paratrooper whom you could drop in wherever you needed something fixed. He was said as someone who doesn't tolerate Democrats at any level. It was his wife, Bill Canary's wife, who prosecuted me.
So why is John Conyers not subpoenaing Bill Canary?
Well, that's a very good question. Canary, just like Gravano was led to Gotti and John Dean led to Nixon, Bill Canary can lead to Karl Rove, and,
right.
and Bill Canary cannot claim executive privilege.
Right, exactly. So, I don't get why John Conyers is not subpoenaing him. Is this something that we need to encourage him to do? Or
I think we do need to encourage them to do this. While we're waiting on Rove to do something or the court to do something about Rove, there are people in Alabama like Bill Canary. Bill Canary is not just an Alabama yokel. This guy, he is a high-level political operative of the Republican Party with better Republican credentials than just about anybody that I know. He happens to live in Alabama because he married a girl from Alabama. Now, keep in mind, Karl Rove also married someone from Alabama, and his house is on the Gulf Coast. Karl Rove has a connection to Alabama. That's why he was here. That's why he saw when I started defeating the toughest Republican candidates that they needed to get rid of me.
Right.
But, again, this is not about Don Sigelman. This is about holding those people responsible who have perverted our Department of Justice and subverted our Constitution.
Right. So, again, let us encourage our listeners, all 3 million of you out there, if you are listening right now, two things to do. One, call Congress. Call John Conyers' office and suggest that the Don Siegelman case be a top priority and that perhaps Bill Canary should be brought before Congress under oath, under subpoena, And callcongress.org, you can get the phone numbers. And number two, go to Don Siegelman. I know you're not going to plug this, but I will. Go to donsiegelman.com or donsiegelman.org. Either one will get you there. I before E, S-I-E-G-E-L-M-A-N, donsiegelman.com. And help out. Help out this effort, because this is not, you know, Don Siegelman is not, again, speaking on behalf of you, but you can at least agree or disagree with the factualness of the statement. You're not one of these multimillionaire Republican fat cat type, you can fund your own thing out of your own back pocket guys.
No, I'm not.
Yeah,
no,
so.
I appreciate your help and would appreciate your listeners' help. But again, we're surviving. We're doing good. We're fighting back. And again, the most important thing is that we find out who hijacked the Department of Justice and hold those people accountable.
Yeah. One of the folks in our chat room mentioned that the prosecutor in California who went after Duke Cunningham had previously gone after a number of Democrats. One of them had died from the stress, you know, freaked out, and they're now looking into those and seeing whether they were political prosecutions. I mean, I don't think that this is confined to Alabama and Bill Canary's wife, Laura.
No, it is not. And again, the only reason why, and as you noted at the beginning of the show, the reason why you're having me on is because this is the shortest route to Karl Rove.
Yeah.
If there was an easier way to go, I would be out there promoting that route. But it just so happens that his fingerprints are all over this case. It's also interesting to note that when John Conyers wrote to Robert Luskin yesterday, Rove's lawyer, he said that the, quote, proposal to separate the Sigelman case from the firings of the U.S. attorneys is unacceptable. That means that Rove has been, they've been trying to separate this case from the U.S. attorney's case.
Mm.
I'm not sure quite why, but it adds to the intrigue that we've got to get Rove before that committee under oath.
Right. And again, like with all good criminal prosecutions, and particularly the mob prosecutions, start at the bottom and work your way up. Let's get Bill Canary before Congress as well. Excellent. Governor Don Siegelman, donsiegelman.org, donsiegelman.com. Check it out. Help out. Governor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Strange one. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Yeah, Mitch Mann Prophecies Diary over at the Daily Kos. I got to tell you, this is... Oh, the last man standing. Yeah, okay, here we are. Took a while to get there. When opposing the Patriot Act, habeas corpus, and other extra-constitutional power grabs. This is from Mitch Mann Prophecies Diary over at the Daily Kos. Just say, this is still America. 9/11 didn't change that. On the gas tax, the government giveth, the oil companies take away. If we thought folks would actually see it, we might support it. Inflation. It's called pass it on to the consumer. It's breaking the working man's back. In Florida, hurricanes coming? Raise insurance rates and pass it on to the consumer. Airlines paying for more fuel? Pass it on to the consumer. Grocery store paying for more for delivery costs? Pass it on to the consumer. Electrical utility companies sustained damage to equipment during a storm? Pass it on to the consumer. State revenue is low? Pass it on to the on and on it goes. What about talking to enemies? Well, the so-called surge is working because we talked to the Sunnis who were shooting at us, and they stopped shooting at us. But we shouldn't talk to the Cubans who have not yet fired a shot. Eh? Don't get that. Or the Iranians, for that matter. Anyhow, he goes through. He's got a whole bunch of them there. I highly recommend it. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And but before I get to that, I just very quickly want to share with you our Watch You Doing Something Right alert for today. This is amazing. This Reuters reporting this. Comprehensive lifestyle changes, including a better diet and more exercise. But rather than read it, let me just tell you about this. We have genes that control the behavior of our body, primarily the manufacture of proteins. It's the main mediator of bodily functions and, you know, systems, how they all work. But a whole bunch of things in addition to that. And what they found, they took this group of men who were diagnosed with a low-risk prostate cancer and didn't want to have surgery or radiation. They had a very slow-growing kind of cancer that probably wouldn't kill them. They'd probably die of other things first. And they said, let's see what a healthy lifestyle does. So they had them eat more fruits, more vegetables, whole grains, legumes and soy products, and walked a half hour a day and did an hour a day of stress management like meditation. Okay, that's all they did. In other words, they ate a more vegetarian and healthy diet. They walked for a half an hour a day, and they chilled out for an hour a day. Spent an hour a day calming down. And then they looked at their genetic profile before and after. And what they found was that after just 3 months of this, over 500 genes, and of course we're only looking at a relatively small number of them right now, although we've mapped the genome, there's not only a fraction that we've identified, over 500 genes had actually changed whether they were turned on or turned off. In other words, these genes were changing their activity. Biologically, these people became, or genetically, these people became different as a consequence of changes in their lifestyle. Dr. Dean Ornish, the head of Preventative Medicine Research Institute in Sausalito, California, who oversaw the study, he says, in just 3 months, I can change hundreds of my genes by changing what I eat and how I live. That's pretty exciting. And the implications of our study are not limited to men with prostate cancer. That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. Well, a lot on our plate today, from gun control to the elections to, you know, what's McCain up to offshore drilling. Devron in Seattle, Washington, listening to Talk 1090. Devron, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to say earlier, George Clinton, an artist, R&B, he talks about painting the White House black all the time. I laugh at it. As a black man, don't take offense, but if you can, it's okay. But back to the gun control.
I don't think it was meant as a this was not meant as a positive. I mean, this was being sold right next to the button about, you know, calling Hillary
I understand. And I just, you know, I try to make light of those when they come negative. But anyways,
to
the gun
wise.
Control, didn't we get the Puritans and didn't Australia get the criminals and the prisoners? And I think they had a similar Columbine incident, and then they banned all their guns, even in the outback in the bush. I don't know what it is with us and our gun control and why we stick to it, and we let our children, you know, idolize them as toys and shoot each other. The other day, my wife witnessed some kids come running back from Walmart and got in their car. These were some these were some children coming in. It doesn't really matter what race, but they were American children, and they started brandishing a firearm in their car. It was just—it's atrocities out here that we got kids out here playing with guns, and we want to talk about the right to bear arms.
Right, Devron. Devron, you ask why it's happening. I'll tell you why it's happening, because it's a multi-billion-dollar industry. You know, that's the bottom line. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry, and the National Rifle Association is basically an industry trade association. And, you know, I say that as somebody who went through one of their gun safety training courses and is therefore a card-carrying member of the NRA. But nonetheless, they're a trade association, for all practical purposes, a front group for their gun industry. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry. Senator Mike Gravel up next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Believe in, it's plenty to get you confused.
34 minutes past the hour. Walking on, Mike Gravel is still walking on. Senator Mike Gravel still fighting the good fight. Joe Luria is with us as well. Joe and Mike are the authors of a new book called A Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism and One Man's Fight to Stop It. Senator Mike Gravel and author Joe Luria, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us, Tom. And you got to understand how this book came about. This is Joe Luria's style. I'm just sort of the victim of life. And what he did is he dug it all up, pulled it together over a two-year period. And so that was the collaboration, me living it, him writing it.
Okay, as Senator Mike Gravel there. Joe Luria, what is... You talk about the rise of American militarism, and you're writing about Mike Gravel's efforts to stop this. Give us a sense of that arc.
I will indeed. First, I'll tell you what the book is not. It is not a campaign book. It's not a celebrity bio. It's not a candidate's book. Mike has retired from politics, but not from the fight. It is a kind of sophisticated self-help book, in a way, giving the reader knowledge that he needs to dispel the false fears that the government has been feeding the American people, particularly since the end of the Second World War, with which they've created their dominant world power and also enriched Congress, the military, and related industries. What it's about is the story of the rise of American militarism from the earliest days, from the earliest days of the Republic, with a special emphasis on the period just after World War II, when, in fact, we compare it with the rise of the War on Terror.
Mm-hmm.
The same situation arose. You know, during the Depression, the only thing that got us out of it was not the New Deal, as Mike could tell us, but is the war. And after the war, there was fear there'd be a new depression again. And the military industry had made such enormous profits and the United States stood astride a totally devastated world with absolutely no enemies, including the Soviet Union. They had only to rebuild themselves, and they suffered the most than anyone else. The military industry, I think, was very reluctant about giving up those profits. And the only thing that was lacking was a war. And Truman then created the National Security State, the CIA, the Defense Department, National Security Agency eventually. And with that, trumped up the fears that allowed the spending to go forward with the military industry that has built the militaristic society that we still suffer under, that we are still living under that period. I think it's the central problem of American life today. One of our other problems derives from that, whether that be education or health care, transportation, all the things we're not spending on to prop up a military machine we don't need.
And where it took a hiatus was, of course, with Dwight Eisenhower, who tried to bring it under somewhat control by trying to have a defense on the cheap by expanding the whole nuclear effort.
Right.
And recognized at the end of his career in office that,
that he'd just been feeding the beast, too.
And then he outlined the threat to our democracy. Now, it's no longer a threat. It has come to pass. We have militarized our culture, and the military-industrial complex controls our government, our institutions, the Congress, the judiciary, the executive, lock, stock, and barrel.
Right. Let me suggest an alternative meme here. Joe Luria, you mentioned what is the standard Republican talking point, which is that we didn't get out of the Great Depression because of the New Deal. We got out of it because of World War II. And that all of this military spending is essentially a good thing and has been driving our economy ever since from an economic point of view. And I would submit to you that's a fundamental error. And the response to that by Democrats historically has been, particularly defenders of the New Deal, is that if you spend $1 million or $1 billion or $1,000, let's say $1 million, you spend $1 million on a bomb and that bomb gets dropped on somebody or never gets used. That's $1 million down a rat hole. That's $1 million that you'll never see again. If you spend that $1 million building a school, you're going to produce 10, 20, 30, $50 million in tax revenues over the next 30 to 50 years as a consequence of the education people get in that school. If you spend that $1 million on a bridge, you're going to produce $2 or $3 million in tax revenues because of the transportation that's made possible by that bridge.
Absolutely.
Let me jump in here.
Yeah.
Tom, that's entirely correct as a theory of some of the people on the left. It's not the theory of the Democratic Party, which you alluded to, because the theory of the actual reality of the Democratic Party was what led us in to Vietnam. And that was that they were controlled by the military-industrial complex.
Well, point taken. Let's say that that's the philosophy of those who agree with the idea of the New Deal. But
the New Deal did not get us out. It did not. In 1936, we had a larger unemployment level than we had in 1933. And it was the war that literally took us out of the Depression. And that's a part of the problem that we face that we've never really understood. But everything you're saying is right. Hey, we don't need to spend more in defense than all the rest of the world. And as we do that, we then skew our entire priorities away from education, away from health care, away from rebuilding our entire infrastructure, and away from a sane foreign policy. And that's the trap we're in, because now they do control us. And how do we get out of that?
Right. And that's the big question. I mean, we can disagree all day long about when we got out of the Great Depression and how and why. But the bottom line is that military spending is no way to stimulate or maintain an economy. It's crazy.
Absolutely.
It's plain old flat-out crazy.
I'd like to put in that Eisenhower in his Iron Cross speech made those very points, that every bomb that's paid for is a schoolhouse that isn't being built. But what I want to say about the end of the about the issue of the Depression is that after every war until the Second World War, the United States demobilized. Companies that made rifles for the Civil War suddenly made bicycles and sewing machines, and it was good. The economy was back. The draft ended. But not after the Second World War. Something fundamentally changed in our country then, and there was no demobilization. There was a partial demobilization, and then it was ratcheted up again, and Truman instituted the first peacetime draft, and we're still living with that, and they're looking for wars and trouble where there isn't in order to get the spending and to keep this false war economy going that we do not need, and the world certainly does not need. A lot of suffering would be averted if we could put an end to this. And only the people, I think the book says clearly, only the people can make an end to it. The people are the enemy of the militarists, both in mass movements, which we've seen, which helped bring the end of the Vietnam War and brought other changes, and Mike's ideas of the National Ballot Initiative. A combination of those two is the only way, I think, and Mike, I think Mike agrees, that we could put an end to militarism that has captured and taken over our country, basically.
Through the National Ballot Initiative. Explain that to Senator Gravel.
Well, here, what it is there's only two possible venues for change. One is the government, representative government, and that's where the problem lies. And that's the difficulty as we march into this election. They talk about change. There's no possibility change can take place. Just follow the money. So if the change cannot take place within the context of representative government, then you have to turn and go to the people. Well, how can the people make change? You have to look to the definition that Cicero had, that the freedom is defined by participation in power. What is power in a democracy? It is lawmaking. So if the people are to participate in freedom and participate in power, they must become lawmakers. We saw this take place in 1848 in Switzerland and at the turn of the century in 24 states where people can make laws at the state and local level. The procedures are not very good, but they're as good. It permits the people to act as reasonably and as maturely as the representative government. And so now what we need is a process that sets up procedures so that people can act in a very deliberative fashion, and that's what the National Initiative is all about, and the Congress will never bring it about, and so the people have to vote
right.
for it themselves.
No, I get it. So at a federal level, we can do like we can do here in Oregon right now, like Californians can do. They can put a ballot initiative on the ballot and get people to vote for it. Now, this is a real two-edged sword, and I can tell you from living in Oregon, where we've seen both the best and the worst of it. Here in Oregon, we have death with dignity. If you can get two doctors to certify that you have 6 months to live, they can prescribe to you that you can take yourself an overdose of barbiturates that you can just drink down and off you go. And we have medical marijuana, both as a result of ballot initiatives. On the other hand, we have had a number of ballot initiatives where right-wing cranks have come into the state with money from out of state, and they push these things with multi-million dollar television campaigns, and people actually believe what they're saying, buy into it, or they use these ballot initiatives to drive conservatives out of the woodwork and into the voting polls so that while they're there, they'll also vote for Republican candidates. It has really cut both ways.
That is because in the 24 states that have ballot initiatives, that the procedures are not very good. And so you can turn around and you solve all of those problems, and I have in this legislation.
So we have a half a minute here left. How do you solve them?
Very simply, you take the money equation out of the factor. You don't let people, if only human beings can vote, then only human beings can put up the money. No corporate money is involved. And then you have a whole deliberative process.
But a lot of the money that's driving these right-wing ballot initiatives here in Oregon is coming from two right-wing millionaires.
All I would recommend is that there's another book besides this Odyssey book, and that is Citizen Power, citizen-power.us. And chapter 2 and chapter 12 in great detail lays out this whole concept of how you can do it properly. And we don't do it properly in this country. They do it properly in Switzerland, but it's a little convoluted.
Okay. Senator Mike Gravel, Joe Lauria, A Political Odyssey, The Rise of American Militarism and One Man's Fight to Stop It. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Great having you on. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Sounds like a good plan here. Dwight Eisenhower, the speech that Mike Gravel and Mike Luria were talking about.
Every gun that is made, every warship launch, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed.
This is the President of the United States.
This world in arms is not spending money alone.
And he was president when he gave his speech.
It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population.
It's one bomber.
It is. Two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
This is Dwight Eisenhower speaking to the American Society of Newspaper Editors, April 16, 1953, the second year of his presidency. We have a winner, by the way, in our contest on our homepage over at TomHartman.com for Sean's favorite blog posting at TomHartman.com. And Sean?
We have a budding author over there today, Ms. Tagger Lee, who says, an amusing study in contrast. On my way into work this morning, I found myself driving behind what appeared to be the epitome of a headbanger's vehicle. All black body, pardon me, with white detailing stickers depicting screaming skulls, flames, etc., the absolute heavy metal machine. As I got close enough to determine what kind of vehicle this was, it turned out to be a Prius hybrid.
Oh,
wasn't you, was it, Tom?
No, it wasn't. So, congratulations to Ms.
Tagger Lee.
There you go. And we will be sending Ms. Tagger Lee a copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, and What We Can Do About It. And What We Can Do About It. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Lowell in Montlake Terrace, Washington. Hey, Lowell.
Hi, Tom. Hey, quick question and comment. What network and show is Newt Gingrich on so we can call him up and give him hell?
Newt Gingrich is a commentator for Fox News, and I'm assuming that he receives a stipend from them or perhaps some substantial payments, and he is an unofficial advisor to the McCain campaign. And why this guy rated being on the Sunday, one of the Sunday news shows this last weekend is absolutely beyond me. I mean, this is absolutely plain old flat out, indescribably crazy. Scott in Matthews, North Carolina. Hey, Scott.
Yes, Tom. Hi. I'd like to get something resolved in 2008 that happened in 2004. The aircraft carriers SS George Washington, Enterprise, and Truman, the people on board that did not get their absentee ballots for the presidential election. So they did not get to vote for their commander-in-chief, who would be the next commander-in-chief. Right. When to get that resolved, that was 15,000 people, and those are just the ones we know about.
Well, you know, Scott, there was only one county as far as I was ever able to find, and I think it was in North Carolina where they actually released the results of the military vote, and the military vote went for John Kerry.
Right.
And you know, because the military knew what was going on in Iraq,
sure.
and I think by and large they were saying, no, we don't want George Bush anymore. And I would suspect that that's probably one of the major reasons, A, why the military vote was never much discussed in the media, because the media was all too busy kissing George Bush's behind. And secondly, why so many people in the military were not even given ballots. So,
right.
You know, good point, Scott, and thanks for pointing it out. I appreciate it. Very well said. Leland in Tigard, Oregon. Hey, Leland.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thank you very much for your time. I want to talk about gasoline.
Okay.
Real fast. I'll try to keep it short. Number one, I think gasoline ought to be put, or all petroleum products ought to be put under the umbrella of utilities, where that any U.S. product that comes out of the ground or out of the ocean is allows the oil companies a reasonable profit. But it's controlled by the federal government or by the states, depending on where it comes from.
Right. In other words, have it regulated like
yes,
utilities.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Number two, no U.S. product of oil or gasoline or diesel should be shipped to any other country or sold to any other country lower than what the American people have to pay for it.
Yeah. Well, those
I
are
mean,
good
when
points.
When we opened up Alaska, thousands and thousands of barrels of oil was sent to other countries all over the world.
Actually, that's been banned since 2000. We mentioned that on the air last week, and a number of people corrected me, and we are no longer shipping oil from Alaska outside the United States. It was banned by an act of Congress. But your point is well taken, and I think well said. We have just a minute here before we got to wrap up the show. Jamie in San Diego. Hey, Jamie.
Hi, Tom. Boy, you've covered a lot of stuff today I wanted to comment on, but I'll stick with my original idea.
Okay.
You were talking earlier about gun control and Jefferson's statement he later recanted about a revolution every 20 years or so.
One he recanted was that sometimes the tree of liberty needs to be watered by the blood of patriots. And he was referring to the French Revolution, and his opinion of that changed dramatically as it got worse.
Yes. Something a lot of Americans don't understand is that most of the European governments, with their parliaments, they have the parliamentary vote of no confidence.
Right.
And that lets them sort of throw the bums out anytime they like. They don't have to wait for the next election cycle. They don't have to have all the blood and horror of a real
right.
revolution.
They can reset the prime minister, basically.
Yeah.
The executive
they don't
branch.
Even have the drama of an impeachment because it's expected.
Yeah.
It's more or less routine.
Yeah. Well, it's not, the problem, Jamie, with doing that here, and excellent point for bringing it up, is that it would require a constitutional amendment to change that in the United States, and that ain't going to happen. I'd just like to see instant runoff voting as a good starting point. Tomorrow, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNS News, is going to be on saying, liberals are forcing socialized transportation on Americans? What? And Jessica Valenti, feminist and writer, is going to talk about her new book, He's a Stud, She's a Slut, and 49 Other Double Standards Every Woman Should Know. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.